Welcome to take two of episode 11 of the Whistleblowers. And John, I got to be honest with you. We recorded a 57-minute episode last week that my phone ate. That was the best episode we've ever done by a wide margin. The lost 57 minutes will live in history.
And you know, we won't be able to repeat it. You know, every time you have a good one like that, you come back and say, well, we got a lot to talk about, and it never really
materializes. It's lost to the sands of time. It's a true tragedy. It's like something in the...
But we can try.
We'll give it a whirl. I'm Luke DeCock, News and Observer sports columnist. John Clockerty with me, as always, former ACC supervisor of officials and Final Four referee. There was a lot to talk about last week and even more to talk about now, so we're actually going to update a little bit with things that have happened. The big thing last week when we sat down, we were just in the wake of the NC State-Miami game, which was not particularly notable except for one play, really. And that play only became notable because NC State's athletic director publicly disagreed with the ACC's interpretation on Twitter. So what happened was, late in that game, Miami's Chris Likes had the ball, sort of. Then he lost it. He was granted a timeout. It was ruled that the timeout was called while he was in possession. Miami went on to win the game. And NC State's gripe was that, they didn't believe a timeout had been called, and B, that Likes wasn't in possession anyway. So, John, just from an official's perspective in a situation like that, what's sort of the procedure there, and how do you deal with the fallout?
Yeah, I saw the play. I was actually watching the game, and reversed it and looked at it a second time, and I think it was a hard play, Luke. In all honesty, Roger Ayers' whistle comes late after the NC State player has the ball. Whether it's a mistake, I don't know if the player was... he wasn't facing Roger, so Roger has to hear him as that player's back is turned to Roger. So Roger's only going to call timeout if he believes he heard that player call timeout. I would not argue. If I was Roger's supervisor, I would say, Roger, you heard him call timeout. And and Roger's going to basically say, yeah. And even though the whistle came late, Roger recognized the timeout. Did he make a mistake? Obviously, if you're a State fan and you have a ball, there was no held ball, there was no foul, you believe that something happened that hurt your team. Luke, let me say that after all the years that I refereed and the years that I was a supervisor, nobody's out there, no officials out there trying to connive to hurt any team. If there was a mistake made, and it was a big mistake because it was in the last minutes of the game, that even compounds it. But there's no conspiracy out there with referees who are saying, okay, we're in the last minute or the last 2 minutes, and I got an opportunity to hose NC State or Miami or Florida State. That doesn't happen. And I'm afraid some of the stuff I read, some of the insinuations that I hear, some of the tweets that I read, that it was just only a matter of time that would happen to NC State. They would get hosed. That evening, that game, and that night, all these games that were being played across the country, there was mistakes made that hurt teams down at the end. Was it a bad call? I'm not going to get it whether Roger made a mistake, he didn't make a mistake, but if he did make a mistake, a mistake was made, but it wasn't made because there was some intent to make that mistake to hurt another team, and that's what I'm seeing. I would just like to tell our audience, our listeners, referees don't ride to games. Referees don't sit in locker rooms and think about all they want to do is get every play they can possibly get right, and when they don't get it right, sometimes there are consequences, but that's what I have to say about that play.
Yeah, I thought the other interesting part of it was, so the guy making that call is Roger Ayers, and there was a lot of in my Twitter feed and my email, a lot of grumbling from State fans about why doesn't the ACC get better referees? Like, there's these better referees hiding somewhere who are going to ride over the rainbow on unicorns. You know, the ACC, and I would say the Big 12 probably work harder than anyone else to get the best referees. This is a guy who's worked Final Fours, who's worked ACC championship games. If you don't think that he's good enough, that's a problem with officiating. That's not a problem with the ACC's officials. I mean, there aren't better officials hiding around the corner somewhere that you can go get.
Luke, I couldn't agree more, and I think the ways... What are we going to do? Are we going to fire Roger Ayers and fire these guys that worked Final Fours? Who are we going to replace them with? Roger Ayers has a heck of a resume, and he will continue to referee the next 10 or 15 years, refereeing big games. Do we need better referees? Everybody needs good referees. But the ACC is not without a top-notch staff who can referee most any game in the country.
Yeah, I think the idea that there's a solution for this that involves getting different people is a little off. I mean, if you look at whatever objective standard you want, there aren't guys out there. There may be younger referees who need a chance and may get that. But to me, the bigger problem is, where are the 10,000 guys working middle school and JV games who may have the talent to work an ACC game someday but aren't going to slog it out for $10 a game and all the abuse from parents? To me, that the issue is bigger than this. The issue is officiating in general. How do we get promising young referees from point A to the ACC without driving them away with low pay and the abuse they take? I mean, I think that's becoming a bigger and bigger issue in every sport, not just basketball.
Luke, that's true. And I have seen things in print about in Referee Magazine where there's a real need for officials, and there's fewer officials now going into it. If you're going to get into the advocation of officiating, you have to have support from your family. You have to have the right job. You have to have the time to train, to go to camps, to get recognized. There's a lot involved. And then when you do, you have to know that there's going to be criticisms that go along with officiating. If you can't handle that, because every official comes under criticism at some point in time. But if you love the game and you think that's something you'd like to do, then you ought to try it. But there's certainly a decline in the number of people going in to officiating, and it's at every level. I can speak for my grandchild who can't find referees to referee middle school.
Yeah.
They had to cancel games. So there is a real need out there, no question.
Yeah, and I think, to me it's twofold. One, you've got to broaden the talent pool and get more people, encourage more people to go into it. And two, you've got to have a better way. This is something that Paul Brazzo had said a couple years ago when I was working on a story that touched on this. If there's a LeBron James of officiating out there, we really don't have any way to identify him and bring him along quickly right now. There's got to be a better way to identify the really talented...
The good ones?
To identify them earlier and find ways to accelerate their progress, because... When there's talent out there, you can't afford to let it slip away for whatever reason. You've got to find ways to keep identify exceptional talent, keep it engaged, develop it, and move it on to the next level. Yeah. I think that's something that's got to happen globally.
Yeah. Just to expound on that a little bit, it's more difficult than one person would think, because one of the places you identify talent is camp. And camps are too cosmetic. And you'll see a guy that can run, he's athletic, he's making good calls, and you'll say, man, I think I can use this guy. I think I can get him in the some games and see how he develops. And the next thing you know, that guy that was at camp looks terrific, and you put him under the lights, and all of a sudden it's not the same guy. Now, camp, he has no coach. Yelling at them, there's the games that are not any consequence, and the next thing you know, the same guy that you really liked. And then the reverse of that, and I'll use one guy for example, you would never take Brian Dorsey out of camp and say, man, this guy's a crackerjack. But give Brian Dorsey, because I've seen him in the toughest games we've ever had, and he's going to stand up, and he is going to be accountable, and he is going to work. Whereas at camp, you may not recognize that.
Sure.
So there's two ends to that. But first of all, that's really where you have to start, and you have to look at camp, and you have to see who these guys that are athletic and can run and keep up with the game, and then you got to give them a chance. You got to give them some games and see how they do.
Yeah. Not to belabor the point here, but if NC State fans were angry last week, they were angrier despite winning Saturday in North Carolina. There was some concerns over the late foul call on sent Cam Johnson to the line to force overtime, which regardless of, you know, that's something that if I'm a fan, I can live with there. That's just a foul call. But I did think it was interesting earlier in regulation, Joel Berry was down behind the North Carolina basket, and NC State had the ball in their own end in possession, and Jamie Lucky stopped play and then allowed Berry to get up and then rejoin the play and then restarted. So I admit that kind of went against how I understand those mechanics. I don't know what the specific rule is, but my understanding was if you stopped play for an injury, that player had to leave the game, or you stopped play while that team was in possession and therefore didn't hurt the opposition, whereas this was a case where you hurt the opposition by stopping play while they're in possession in the offensive end and then allow that player to rejoin. You've essentially granted an advantage to the team, the injured player's team. How is that supposed to be handled?
I'm not quite sure about the rule, but I didn't think that player, once you stop play, if a trainer comes out to attend, or any team attendant, a trainer, coach comes out to attend that player has to leave. I think if no trainer comes out, then even though you stop play, I don't think that player, but I saw the play, and quite honestly, I was really concerned, I guess, watching it, and the way it was handled, simply because Joel Berry was down for a while. There was no whistle. Then when the ball got up into the front court and you have 5-on-4, once Jamie Lucky blew the whistle, Joel Berry gets up and comes up the floor. And in my opinion, that now that really looks bad, because now you've taken an advantage or a disadvantage and made it even with 5-on-5. If Jamie would have blown the whistle when Joel Berry went down, even if they're bringing the ball up and you stop
the ball still in the backcourt.
Backcourt, then you could say, you know, I was concerned for his, but when he blew the whistle and now Joel Berry gets up and doesn't go out of the game and comes up, and now you put the ball in at half court, it just, to me, your host as a referee, and you know, I have great feeling for these guys that I that were on my team, but your host at that point in time, you I don't know how you explain that and to your supervisor and say, you know, that doesn't cut it. That's how I see it.
Yeah, you know, I can see the devil's advocate case as well, which is he was down and he stayed down, and I was worried about it being a serious injury at that point, so I blew the whistle. But obviously, like, you know, you want to err on the side of player safety, but at that point, you know, if the player turns out not to be hurt, which is the case, and the trainer doesn't come out, you know, then you put yourself in it's a tough situation. But the issue that we get back to here is, you just made this point, no one's sitting around trying to come up with ways to hose team A or team B. But that's a situation where, unlike the Harris call,
right,
and unlike
right.
the Cam Johnson foul, this is a situation where a State fan actually has some ammunition to say, even, you know, regardless of what actually happened, it looks bad.
It looks like, yeah, just what you said. You're trying to, you know, you're trying to find a reason to make to take the advantage away from NC State. You know, sometimes you get caught, and there was a Florida State Miami game, and in that game, I think maybe went overtime too. I'm not sure, but it did go overtime. But there was a play in that game in which they're trying to, Miami is trying to get a foul to get a Kamaji, who is a poor free throw shooter. Mm-hmm. Now he's away from the ball. Leonard Hamilton has not been involved in the officiating, and I'm watching the game because my son Tim had the game, but they chased Kamaji down and grabbed him
away from the ball. And that is supposed to be.
That should have been an F1, two shots and the ball, and they called it just a foul. Now Leonard is like, I mean, this is an overtime.
Sure.
And how do you, Leonard wants an explanation on why that's not an intentional foul. Because Kamaji's, he's staying as far away from...
He's deliberately put Kamaji as far away from the play as possible.
Yeah, and then the next whistle, he takes Kamaji out of the game.
Sure.
He doesn't want him in there. So sometimes you wonder now, like, what were they thinking, and should they have upgraded it to an F1? And so, again, we go back to mistakes made. You just hope they're not made in the last minutes or so.
Yeah, I guess we can vouch for the objectivity of this podcast now, since you've just taken the red pen out to one of Tim's games.
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you, I talked to Tim about it, and although he didn't call it, I said, you're a part of that crew. You could have upgraded that. You could have gone to the person that blew it and said, listen, we need to think about this, and because Leonard was 100% right.
Sure.
That was an intentional foul. And if he loses that game, there's a lot of heartburn coming down.
Yeah, it's funny, and it's funny sometimes how fine these margins can be, and how this stuff can come down to one little play like that. And one of the things, John, that we've alluded to in the past on this podcast and haven't really dug into a lot, and I used to actually think this was a good idea. I don't necessarily now, although I think there are some merits to it, is... Would officiating at the ACC, at the Power 5 level, be better if some officials were full-time employees of the league or conference? This is something that we've bounced around occasionally, but haven't really dug into. I know you don't necessarily think it would be a good idea, but what would you see, and this is something I'm sure that was brought up to you when you were a supervisor, what do you see as the relative pros and cons of something like that?
Well, I think one of the pros is that you control the officials' schedule. They're no longer independent contractors. You can assign them the amount of games that you want them to assign. There's more time for training. You have control of their schedules in the summertime. Rather than traveling all over the country night after night, you have, maybe you want to give them 10 games a month rather than officials working 20 games a month. So, you know, there are some positives. And at one time, Luke, and this goes back a number of years, but Dave Gavitt was the commissioner of the Big East. And Dave Gavitt, being proactive, thought about it, looked into it. And it was just, at that time, it certainly financially wasn't something they could do. I mean, it's not just getting these guys as employees. You've got retirement accounts, you've got insurance, you're an employee. Now you're going to put a bunch of officials as employees of the Big East. So it wasn't doable, but it was a good thought. But personally, I don't think you're solving the officiating problems. I'm talking about on-court problems.
Sure.
Not the travel. You're not solving those problems by hiring full-time officials. I read weekly, whereas the NBA is having a lot of problems with their officials to the point where they're forming committees. Adam Silver is forming committees to sit down with coaches, officials, players, because there's such an angst going on between the officials and the players. Players getting thrown on. I mean, Kevin Durant didn't have two technical fouls in his whole career, and now he's got 10 this year or something, or whatever it is. I don't think hiring full-time officials is going to solve the problem. There are some benefits, and then you have the controls I mentioned, but you are officiating is an imperfect advocation, and there's going to be mistakes, and there's going to be mistakes that are costly. That's not going away. Now, we had some coaches that were in the league when I was the supervisor that says that's the only way we're going to solve the officiating problem is make them employees, make them full-time. I can't agree with it. I just don't see the problems going away, on-court problems. The game is too fast. The players are too physical. The coaches are always a step ahead of us. You know, they are. I mean, they're with their players every single day, and that we were always in a catch up mode when it came to catching up to the coaches and the players, and they're so good and so big that, you know, we implement every rules every year. You saw a play. These verticality plays where guys are getting hit in the chin and so forth, we had to do something about that. We had to do something about basket interference. These are blink of the eye decisions.
Does it not germane to the full-time, part-time argument, but does it make it easier when certain rules or certain plays become calls by rule, like the two hands? Does that make it easier?
I think. Luke, yeah. Once they start calling hand checking on the perimeter, and they kept it up, we saw some players and coaches pulling their hair out. But now, even in my last years, we heard coaches saying, "Keep your hands off." As soon as they blew the whistle for hand checking, you'd hear the coach says, "I told you to keep your hands off." So yes, some of that did have an effect, and it cleaned up the perimeter hand-checking play. Post-play, they continue to work on post-play because the big guys down there are still very physical. So they're always trying to make it easier for the referees and making things absolute. You know, yeah. This is two hands on the dribbler is an absolute.
I'm always amused. This is something that's come up in all of our episodes, that it's getting harder and harder to officiate in the post. At the same time, college basketball in general, is becoming more and more of a perimeter game. It seems counterintuitive.
Yeah.
You know, you'd think back in the Big East days of Mourning and Ewing and guys like that, it would have been harder with those big guys down in the post. But it's the game is so much more physical now than it was then, even with fewer sort of impact post players.
Yeah.
Officiating part of it has gotten harder.
You probably see more games than most anybody, or 90%, but the game is a perimeter game, and so much of it is dribble drive. They want to get into the lane. If they have a look at the basket, hopefully get fouled, or if they don't, it's dribble drive, pass to the corner.
Yeah.
Or pass outside.
And you've got help defenders jumping in,
yeah,
and all,
and yeah, you know,
shot blockers.
And then, you know, now we got the screen and rolls. Everybody's up on top of the thing, setting screens, rolling down. But still, when you get two big post players posting up, there's going to be contact, and officials are going to have to make decisions on if the play is too rough.
Yeah, and back just real quick to wrap up the full-time employees discussion. You know, obviously, you've got a pretty solid case against it, and honestly, as an outsider, I used to think it made sense. You know, get some control over blah blah blah, and you know, and you know, you can really sort of direct these guys. But I think the more I've watched it, especially now that these cooperatives, you know, with the Big East and A-10 and Colonial, where you can have a guy work a game in, you know, Providence one night and then Boston the next, instead of working a game in Austin one night and Boston the next, it seems like there's a little a stronger degree of rationality in some of the scheduling.
One of the arguments or points were made that referees are tired because they're working too much. And referees, Luke, for people that are listening, referees have a pattern. And contrary, they are rested, because a referee will get into a town, take the first flight in, because he has to have backup flights. So he'll get into a town and have lunch. Now he's taking a power nap after lunch for 2 or 3 hours prior to getting himself ready to go to the gym. So he's getting his rest, especially if he doesn't have a long distance to travel. So he's getting in, he's getting his rest, you know, and he's relaxed. What happens is, if that process, if that pattern is interrupted due to weather, and he's fighting to get there on time, and things are, he's at an airport, and then he's making flight changes and even having to rent a car, then he can get to that game, and he's frazzled because he has spent all day trying to get there. That doesn't happen a lot, and you hope it doesn't as few times as possible, but it does happen, and then he's there, and he's got to work 40 hard minutes, or actually two hours of minutes. But I think the argument that officials are tired is overstated. Most officials are not, and once they get their rest, they're ready to go. It's the few times that they're fighting to get there, and weather is interrupted or whatever.
Okay. Wanted to ask you about something else completely different. We've seen more in the NBA and lately in college of television broadcasts that have a lot of people mic'd up in the NBA and lately on FS1. In college basketball, there was a game a few weeks ago between DePaul and Providence where both coaches were mic'd up. And I know you watched it. What was your take on that?
I just think, Luke, that's a bad idea by the network. I think it's a bad idea for the conference to allow it. We had that situation where they wanted to mic one of my referees in the ACC tournament. I was dead set against it. Fred Bearcat thought it was okay. I said, no, Fred, I can't agree. To the point where I would have probably taken it to my commissioner if it was pushed any harder. I think that conversations, whether you're micing a coach, whether you're micing an official, I think conversations between coaches and players, coaches and officials, officials and players should be private conversations. There could be things said by an official to a coach that the audience listening to would say that was totally out of line. But to that coach who knows the official, who's talking to the official, it's not out of line. But things can get misinterpreted, and it can cause a firestorm. But I think when Fox Sports 1 had DePaul Providence, it didn't come across. I think the coaches were trying to had their own agenda, and one was being humorous, the other was being more serious, and you could hear him talking about to one official regarding another official, and I just don't think that's this goes I just think. Coming on the floor with a TV camera, trying to get in a coach's huddle during a timeout, which they're doing a lot of now.
Sure.
Okay, they're listening to our coaches in that huddle and describe plays and so forth. I just think that's a scary ground to go to. You could say something. I mean, we got some coaches that can use some strong language at times. And you don't want that out there.
I mean, I totally get all that. And certainly there's some elements of the coach official and coach player conversation that do need to remain private. But I'll tell you, sometimes when they got the cameras in these huddles, you learn so much.
Oh,
it's amazing. From a viewer.
Yeah.
I mean, even just from a writer's perspective, that kind of insight into a huddle or a play. I mean, I remember watching one game where they had the camera and the microphone in a team's huddle, and the coach started drawing something up, and one of his players suggested something different, and they did that instead, and it worked. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, let's say there's both two sides of that, but I think again, having them That's a different situation, and I can see where the ACC says, okay, that's safe. Let's do that, or let's bring them in before the game and watch your pregame talk to your players, and they do a lot of that too. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think that's safe, but to have a mic on that coach, or a mic on the referee, or a mic on the coach who's talking to a referee during the heat of the game. I think that's dangerous ground.
I like the transparency of it. I like the insider feel of it. But I hadn't considered one of the issues that you just raised, which is a coach with an agenda who knows he's mic'd up, especially in one of these FS1 games where that is, to a certain extent, the audio, as opposed to showing a clip or something.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the coach who is mic'd up may be saying things that he wouldn't say if he wasn't mic'd up, deliberately to create an impression push a political agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, I have no idea whether the league was satisfied with it, with the experiment, or said, no, we're not going to do that anymore. I think the officials were probably, not just those officials who were involved in the game, but officials in general say, I won't want that in my game that I'm working.
And John, just to circle back to something we touched on earlier, and this is something people have asked about, how from an official's perspective, how is an official held accountable on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis? Obviously, over the course of a year and over the course of a career, your assignments will change, your offers will change, you'll move up, you'll move down based on performance and fitness and age and all those things, experience. But in the course of a season, how does that accountability work?
Yeah, Luke, all the games are reviewed. And, I know when I was officiating, I heard that word accountability from the coaches. We're accountable to, in our press post-game, the tough questions will be asked. But where does the officials just move on to the next game? Is there any accountability? We had coaches ask that a lot. And then when I became a supervisor and a coach, whether it was the ACC or the Colonial or the Atlantic 10, they would say, he's getting off easy. They miss calls and we lose games. But they just, the next day, I see them working somewhere else. Is anybody making them accountable? Well, we don't like to accept mistakes. When I was the supervisor, and it caused me a lot of heartburn, but we look at every single game, and we look at trends, and we look at officials, a particular official, is he not living up to what our expectations as an ACC official? Is he constantly missing calls? And when you say accountable, everybody wants to be at the high level, but sometimes we have to take guys in and say, your grades are consistently low. You're always in the bottom part of our grading system. So we're going to either cut your schedule back, or we're just going to replace you and move on with some other people. But I had to fire, I had 54 referees, Luke, and every year out of that 54, 10% was not going to be hired back. And out of 54, six were not going to get hired back. And those six were guys that I didn't feel like were doing the job. And my commissioner expected me to do that.
Sure.
He says, we got to reward those that are doing the job, and we've got to basically do something with those that are not doing the job. So to say an official doesn't have accountability is not accurate. They are, and it happens at every league, whether it's the Colonial, again, Atlantic 10, the ACC, like anything else. The only thing that we're, as a supervisor, I need production. I need good production out of the official. So there is a accountability. And again, you look at the staff now, and look at the staff that I had 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and even before I retire, you know, and there's a lot of new faces.
Yeah.
And you're going to see more new faces and fewer older faces.
Yeah. And I could name, you know, and this is some of this is personal preference based on who the supervisor is. Some of it, I assume, is numbers. But there were three or four guys I can think of off the top of my head who were working ACC games your last year who haven't the last 2 years.
That's right. That's right. And you know, the other thing, you got to keep your staff. You got to hire people, and the staff has to know if I'm refereeing non-conference games and I'm doing the job, I need to be rewarded by moving up to conference games, because that's, and then the next level is I'm refereeing conference games well enough that I should get invited. Billy Covington went from non-conference games to conference games to elite, what I say, they're all important conference games, to the ACC tournament, because he was doing the job at every level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good example. If Billy Covington wasn't doing those jobs, you wouldn't doing a good job, you wouldn't see him in those games.
So he's worked his way up
he's
to the tournament.
He's worked his way up. He earned it. Everybody say, oh, John, you gave me a great chance. No, you know what? You earned that. You know, if you didn't do it, I couldn't have moved you up. And Billy Covington's a guy that's refereeing every game pretty at a pretty good high level. Luke, you've asked me some questions this afternoon. I'm going to
That's my job, John. That's my job.
Yeah, that is. That's right. Well, I want to ask you about part of your job and part of maybe some beat writers. But I read your column, your commentary, and I've told you numerous times I enjoy it. And one of the things that I think, the reason I enjoy it, I think you're straightforward, and when there may be what you think needs to criticisms or situations and in different situations. I'm not quite how to word it, but you say it straight out in your commentary in the columns. But sometimes I'd like to ask you. We have beat writers that cover Carolina State, Duke, and these beat writers, do they ask the tough questions, or do they soften it because they want to remain in favor of that particular coach, or afraid that the administrator of that school can come back to them and say, you don't need to be critical of our coaches? I don't know, not only in basketball, but also maybe in football and so forth. But I think beat writers, in my opinion, tread lightly. And, you know, you can agree or disagree, but I'd like to have your take on that.
Well, one, yeah, I would disagree, and I think it does depend on the beat writer. But I think generally speaking, the good ones, the ones that I respect, do a very good job of holding the schools they cover accountable. And to be honest with you, you know, some of that isn't public. You know, I tell people all the time, I never ask my best question in a press conference because I don't want everyone else hearing it or getting the answer. I'm always going to ask my best question offline somewhere, in a hallway or by text message or phone. I'm never going to spill what I have to my competition. I don't want them hearing it. Now, if a press conference is the only time that person is going to be available and you have no choice but to do it there, then yes, I'm going to ask my question. But grandstanding in press conferences is no way to get the job done. It's a great way to go and get on the Twitters or whatever. But if I have a really good question, I'm going to ask multiple people, and I'm not going to do it in front of where anyone can hear it because I don't want the competition hearing it. You know, like, but that doesn't mean that beat writers don't. You know, Joe Giglio is a state grad who covered NC State for a long time, is on UNC now. You know, he did a terrific job of holding NC State accountable. You didn't always see it. You know, sometimes it's the questions you ask by text message or behind the scenes. You know, and certainly anyone who's watched any of his press conference exchanges with Mark Gottfried or Dave Doran would know he certainly doesn't soft pedal them. You know, he's got Joe's whole yellow pad chart thing started with tracking NC State football's use of Jalen Samuels because he felt J. Sam was underutilized. And the next thing you know, he's got Doran snapping at him in press conferences, put that in your chart. You know, I mean, that's part of the job. By the same token, you know, you can have a very good relationship with these people because the good ones, and the vast majority of them are, just as the vast majority of journalists at this level are good at what they do, the good ones understand that you have a job to do and they have a job to do.
There's a degree of professional courtesy that's expected. But you can disagree or be critical and still have a good relationship if you're honest and open and give people a chance to tell their side of the story. I'm sure there are beat writers out there. I know there are beat writers out there, some of them, none who work for us, but certainly they're out there, who pander to the programs they cover and the fans. You see it happen more in one newspaper, one college, or one newspaper, one pro team towns. For us, with the three schools here, plus East Carolina, plus Wake, plus all the other smaller colleges, plus the Hurricanes, you know, it would be very difficult for us to play one side against the other. You know, NC State fans like to complain about the NNO and say, oh, you guys all went to Carolina, which isn't true. Mm-hmm. And UNC fans like to say, oh, you guys are all out to get us, which also isn't true. I feel like there's a great meet and greet somewhere between all the NC State fans who think all the NNO writers are a bunch of UNC homers and the UNC fans who think all the NNO writers are a bunch of NC State homers. If you do this job, not everyone's always going to be happy with you. But if you treat the people you cover with respect and act like a professional and do this job professionally, you know, you can write things that may reflect poorly on them and not have them think you're out to get them. Have them acknowledge that you may have a point. By the same token, you may write positive things where you acknowledge that they may have a point, even if it's something you disagreed with previously. So, you know, I can go from criticizing something about NC State one day to writing a story about how good NC State's fall sports were the next, because mm-hmm. those two things are not incompatible, and they're not, they can exist next to each other because they're both true. I think most beat writers, certainly those, almost all of them in the ACC and all the ones I work with, are professional people who want to do the job right, who don't play favorites, who ask tough questions whether you see it or not. And do a good job and write and tell good stories, which to me is really at the heart of this job, is we're news reporters and we're storytellers, and we have to be able to do both. So
is there a difference between being a beat writer for the Hurricanes and being a beat writer for one of our local schools? Is it treated the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you're covering the Hurricanes and the team is good and we're traveling, you're working a lot more because you've got 82 games and you're on the road for 41 of them, plus preseason, plus rookie camp, plus the All-Star game, plus the draft, plus potentially the playoffs, which is a lot more than any college writer is going to do over the course of football and basketball season. But the job doesn't change. I say this to people all the time. I say, oh, I could never cover hockey. I don't know hockey. I mean, yeah, there are nuances to it and subtleties and things that you're going to have to pick up. But in the end, there's a winner and a loser. And there's probably a hero and a villain and a goat. And, you know, there are certain things about any athletic contest that should be obvious to the least competent storyteller. I won an award once for a story I wrote about rodeo. What do I know about rodeo? I know nothing about rodeo. But if there's a story to be told there, you need to go and be able to tell it. And whether that's hockey or college basketball or football, we're lucky. I'm lucky to work here where I happen to love hockey and I happen to love college basketball. I'm not the world's biggest college football fan, but I acknowledge that it's a big deal to some people and I deal with it. And I used to like it a lot more than I do. I've been beat down by some of the football I've had to watch over the last 10 years. But, you know, for the most part, the one big difference I would say in how you approach those beats is you're going to be harder. You're going to hold the Hurricanes players to a higher standard because they are professionals. Whereas college players, as even though they get scholarships, and even though if you choose to go to one of these schools, you're accepting that you're going to have time in the media spotlight. Because if you don't, then go somewhere else. You know, that's part of playing at State or Duke or Carolina. You know, you become a celebrity at the college athlete level, or you can, and there's that responsibility. But I think, you know, especially as a columnist, you're going to be a lot harder on a professional player for making a boneheaded mistake or something like that. You're going to be more sympathetic with a college player who screws up because, you know, these are, predominantly speaking, still kids. They're technically amateur athletes, although that's a whole different podcast.
Yeah.
But as a columnist, I'm not going to be as hard on a college player for, you know, Chris Webber calling timeout as I would with a professional player in that situation who should know better.
Yeah, the only I think back about people, I don't know if they're beat writers or not, asking Bill Parcell a question and knowing they're going to get slammed, and asking a similar question to a guy like Mike Tomlin, who will digest it and give him
Even in our market. So Mike Krzyzewski has a reputation of being fearsome in press conferences and intimidating. And the fact is, if you ask a bad question, he's probably going to slap you around verbally a little bit. And most of the time, the person who asked that question deserves it. Most of the time. Sometimes he's just venting.
You put Coach Boeheim in that same category?
No, I wouldn't, because I think Boeheim's got a little more dismissiveness about him. If you ask him a bad question, he's just going, I don't know.
Yeah,
Mark Gottfried's famous line was, I don't know about all that. That was how he'd deal with the question whose premise he disagreed with instead of arguing with you. But if you ask Mike Krzyzewski, and I think this is the thing people don't understand, whether you're a writer for the Duke Chronicle, or you're for Sports Illustrated, or you're with the NNO, if you ask a question that is a good question, you will get a really good answer most of the time. Not always. Most of the time. He will, I asked him the other day after Saturday's game about, with a minute to go, Trey Duvall gets the ball in his own end, and he tries to throw a baseball pass up the court, and Virginia picks it off. And then Jerome comes down, hits the big three, boom, game's over. And I said, your players said that that's an error that they can live with because you're always trying to push the ball up. And Kay said, well, yes and no. Yes, that is something we like to do. But no, you've got to know at that point the situation and time, which is certainly what I thought.
Yeah.
This is a freshman thinking, ooh, we're trying to push the ball, and not, oh, wait, we have the ball with 1 minute to go in a whatever it was, 1 point game or whatever it was at that time. You want to hold that ball for 29 seconds.
Yeah.
You want to give Virginia as little time to respond. Or you want to go 2-for-1. But what you don't want to do is throw a low percentage pass up the court.
That cost you.
That ends up costing you the game indirectly. You know, there's obviously other things going on there. And one play never costs you a game, just as one official's call never costs you the game. If you were in a position where one call should hurt you, you should have been up 10.
That's what
I used to tell Hurricanes fans. The officials are out to get us. They never call penalties. Well, if you're up 2-0, that power play is not that big a deal. Then you kill it or you don't, but you still have the lead.
It's like,
if you're always down a goal, then it becomes a really big deal.
And if you're up by 20 in basketball, that misses that the official made, it's not important. But
yeah, and it happens. And I think I think there's a little of that with NC State, where over the years their teams have been more on a razor's edge than UNC and Duke, so they feel the pain of a missed call maybe a little more. And then it becomes self-perpetuating. Everything becomes a slight against you. When you look at these plays this last week, you can understand how they would feel aggrieved.
Yeah.
Even if you can take a more rational perspective and say, well, the first one is just sort of a error in judgment or, with the timeout call and the Cam Johnson foul. I mean, you got a player driving to the basket and there's contact. That's, you're going to get a lot of times the home team is going to get that call no matter who the visiting team is. And then the injury thing, we could debate how that should have been handled or could have been handled.
But for a state fan, it's easy to sit here, but there's
a devil's advocate case to be made there too, where Barry stays down long enough that you're worried that he is seriously hurt.
Yeah. And I think it deserves some thought. Maybe he thought it was worse than he originally thought it was.
And then you end up just looking stupid and the guy hops back up.
Runs up court.
That's, and then you're like, then you maybe shoot the guy a little side eye on that one.
We'll wrap this up in a little bit, but I know my first year as a supervisor, I had a coach call me and not happy at all about a play or two that at the end of the game, and I had the stat sheet in front of me, and being a novice at my position, I just says, Coach, you didn't make half your free throws. If you would have made just a couple more free throws, and there was silence at the other end. And he came back and says, John, that has nothing to do. My free throw shooting has nothing to do. We were good enough to be there at the end.
Yeah.
Regardless if we made half our free throws or all of our free throws, we were there at the end. And those calls cost me. And he wasn't as that kind as I just said there, okay?
Can't imagine
he wasn't that kind, but I learned that I stay away from what you didn't do and what my officials should have done.
Tend your own garden, John, is basically is what that, he was telling
yeah, you. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you let me worry about what we screwed and up.
He didn't say it, like, but that's what he was telling
and
me.
You go worry about what your guys screwed up.
That's right.
All right, well, we're 7 minutes short of where we were last week. Those are definitely the 7 minutes that made a difference.
Very good.
So we're 7 minutes in time and quality below last week.
Good.
We have some work to do. But again, as always, if you have questions, if you have topics you'd like us to discuss, we are happy to do that. LDcock at newsobserver.com, at Luke Decock on Twitter. We'd love to hear your comments, criticisms, questions. We'll take it on. We've missed, John. This is like the second episode in a row where we haven't taken a stroll down memory lane with you. So,
You know, I'll tell you what I can do. And before we meet again, I'm going to write down some things, some stories, some experiences, some good, not so good. There can be a whole session. Not that you always have to listen to what I like.
That's all right, John. No one's still listening anyway.
But anyway, you can ask me some questions and I could tell you some of the things that.
All right, I'm gonna throw out some names then. This is your homework.
Okay.
Are you ready? Dean Smith.
Okay.
Terry Holland.
Okay.
Louis Carnesecca.
Okay.
Jim Boeheim.
Okay.
You've got to come up with one.
Okay.
One story for each of those guys.
Okay.
And they better be amusing.
Okay, we'll do it.
All right, John. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, I'm Luke Decock, News and Observer sports columnist, and my colleague, John Clockerty. Thanks very much for listening, and we will be back soon.